It's very good to see everybody here this morning. Please have your Bibles open to Psalm 78. We're going to be looking in Psalm 78 for most of our lesson this morning. But by way of introduction, I'll tell you a little bit about something that my family saw a few weeks ago up in Utah. We took a trip to Zion National Park and stayed a few days there, enjoyed ourselves very much. We did some hiking and some sightseeing, and after one day of hiking, there was one more thing we wanted to go see. There is a ghost town in southern Utah called Grafton, Utah. It was a lovely evening. It was warm outside and sunny, and we both concluded that during the daytime, this ghost town was just a lovely place, but we definitely wouldn't want to stay there at night, especially after we discovered the gigantic tarantula crawling around that we picked up and played with. Please don't call CPS. There is a graveyard, though, in Grafton, Utah, that was particularly interesting, and I want to tell you about a few of the graves that we saw there. This family, the Gibsons, they were all buried together. Many of them lived to be quite old. You can notice on the first headstone there, born 1800, died 1871. We were both very impressed that anybody in the 19th century lived to be 71 years old, especially under the rough conditions they would have faced living in southern Utah, carving out an existence for themselves as ranchers and farmers. There was another headstone that we found, though, and it was actually three people on the same headstone. It was two brothers and one of their wives, the Berry family. It says that they were killed in 1866, killed by Indians. Because I guess in 1866, you just like to have some very blunt information on your headstone. But imagine the story that must have been behind their lives. Two brothers and one of their wives heading to Utah. Perhaps they bought a piece of ground, thought they might make a ranch or a farm out of it. A struggle, perhaps at first. Maybe they made some money along the way. Maybe they got a few seasons in. Then they were surrounded and killed, seen as interlopers by the natives in the area. My brother Kyle, who you know, came with us on this trip along with his family, and we both looked at each other and just thought, imagine what it would be like for the two of us, brothers, heading off into the unknown, trying to make a life for ourselves. But surrounded by all these beautiful headstones were these mounds in the ground, unmarked. No headstones, no names, no dates, no information. But a person died and was buried there nevertheless. No story to tell. Perhaps no family members alive today to come back and tell whatever story it was that he had. And yet, even without a headstone, without a name or any other information, a date of birth or a date of death, doesn't this mound in the ground still tell a story? It tells a story that this was somebody buried who came to this land thinking that he might make a life. And yet when he died, he left behind nobody who was willing or interested in putting a headstone up. Maybe he had no kids, no family. We all leave a story behind, don't we? Whether it's a really interesting story or a really boring story, we all leave a story behind. Maybe another word for a story would be a legacy. Your life is a legacy of sorts. And that is why I've had you open up to Psalm 78, because Psalm 78, in a way, is the legacy of the people of Israel. It's their story, told in short snippets where you get the main events of the great Exodus, their wandering through the wilderness, their great acts of faithfulness and unfaithfulness, often more acts of unfaithfulness than not. And the psalm ends with a hopeful but uncertain future under King David. Your legacy does say something. It teaches, whether you want it to or not, it teaches something. Your kids will remember who you are, how you lived, the decisions you made. Were you a good parent or a bad parent? Your grandchildren, too. Your spouse, a congregation, neighbors. And again, maybe you leave a very interesting story and a lot of people know a lot about you, or maybe you leave a very small story and few people know anything about you. In the end, though, God knows everything. And even if you don't want your legacy remembered by somebody in this life, God will recall everything on the day of judgment. We don't get to choose how others react to our story. You realize that? You don't get to choose how your kids remember you. Now, you do what you can to be the kind of parent that you ought to be, but in the end, it's up to them to interpret your life as they want. And perhaps this was a little bit of why Solomon was so frustrated in the book of Ecclesiastes, where he talks about his legacy in Ecclesiastes chapter 2. He says here in verse 18, "Thus I hated all the fruit of my labor for which I had labored under the sun, for I must leave it to the man who will come after me." Now, maybe that's your stuff or your wealth or your reputation, but whatever it is that makes up you is left behind here in this world. And who knows whether he'll be a wise man or a fool, yet he will have control over all the fruit of my labor for which I'd labored by acting wisely. This too is vanity. "Therefore I completely despaired," he says in verse 20, "of all the fruit of my labor for which I'd labored, when there is a man who has labored with wisdom, knowledge, and skill." And then he gives his, what is that word? Then he gives his legacy to one who has not labored with them. "This too is vanity and a great evil." You will be an object lesson, though, whether you like it or not. In a sermon from last week, I mentioned that nobody is completely useless because, at the very least, we can all serve as bad examples to the people around us. And it's not likely that the unfaithful in Israel would have wanted their story retold the way it is in Psalm 78. If you've ever studied Psalm 78, it's not a very pretty picture that's painted for most of the psalm. There are bits and pieces that are optimistic or positive, but most of the psalm is really recounting the failures of Israel, especially in the wilderness. And if you had asked any of those people that first left Egypt, that first crossed the Red Sea, if you had asked them, "Would you like us to retell your story 500 years from now? Would you like us to tell coming generations about all of your failures? Would you like us to tell them about Korah and Korah's rebellion, or murmuring in the wilderness, or about that time you stuffed your faces with so much quail that it came out your nostrils? Would you like us to tell that story about you?" But the thing is, how you live and when you die, you don't get to pick and choose which stories people tell about you later on. So let's begin here in Psalm 78 and verse 1. "Listen, O people, to my instruction. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we've heard and known and our fathers have told us. We will not conceal them from their children, but tell to the generation to come the praises of the Lord, His strength, and His wondrous works that He has done." Isn't it interesting that in the midst of all of the spiritual failures, there is God, a constant, strong, virtuous, wondrous in all that He does. "For God established a testimony in Jacob," He says in verse 5, "and appointed a law in Israel which He commanded our fathers, that they should teach them to their children, that the children to come might know," even the children yet to be born, "that they arise and tell them to their children." Verse 7, "that they should put their confidence in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments and not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not prepare its heart, whose spirit was not faithful to God." Seems like it starts off really well, doesn't it, in Psalm 78? But it doesn't take very long for the writer to realize that in the midst of telling this great story about God and His wondrous works, he cannot help but mention Israel. Israel was a stubborn and rebellious people, and they had many spiritual failures. But before we castigate them too much from the perspective of the armchair historian, let's remember that we too have a lot of failures in our own lives. I just want us to put ourselves in Psalm 78 this morning. Put yourself in this psalm and imagine what it would be like if somebody was going to tell your life story. If somebody was going to recount your legacy. Was it a legacy of faithfulness? Was it a legacy of hard work? Was it a legacy of putting God first in all things? A legacy of loving your family, loving your spouse, even loving your enemies? Or was your legacy one of laziness, one of unfaithfulness, one of stubbornness and rebellion? What is your legacy? We oftentimes leave very confusing stories behind, don't we? When people look back on our lives, there are very high points, but very low points. And we wonder, where did that low point come from? In the midst of all the good that that person did, why that one low point? And by the way, biographers and movie makers love to point out the low point in a famous person's life. You ever watched a docudrama or something like that? A movie about some person's life, and in the midst of all of the great things they did, they have to find the drama. Where's the drama in your life? Where's the thing that sticks out like a sore thumb in your life? Because like the Israelites leaving Egypt and witnessing all of those wonders in the wilderness, many of us are given great advantages and very few excuses for our failure. One might look back and wonder, his parents were great. He had great preaching, great leadership in the church. He had the Bible in his hands available to him at all times. Look at all of the advantages. Why did he fail like that? With everything going right for that person, why the failure in the midst of all that? Now, I'll admit, nobody's upbringing is perfect. And perhaps you didn't have good parenting. And perhaps you didn't have economic advantages in your upbringing. Perhaps you struggled and starved. But at the very least, you were alive. And you always had the sun shining on your head. And you always had God who you could pray to. You always had forgiveness available to you. You always had the church. Even when sometimes the people in the church might have disappointed you or failed you, you always had the church as the body of Christ. You always had the Word of God. So no pity party here. There's no sob stories in God's eyes because we have all been given incredible, incredible advantages that basically nullify all of those excuses. There's a strange disconnect that occurs when our advantages do not translate to moral or spiritual success. As you can see here on the screen, I've noted on first point verses 12 through 16, where he describes all the things that God did, where he wrought wonders before their fathers. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through it. He made the waters stand up like a heap in verse 14. He led them with the cloud by day and all the night with a light of fire. He split the rocks in the wilderness. He gave them abundant drink like the ocean depths. He gave these people in the wilderness many advantages. But notice all of the times that they failed in spite of their advantages. Verses 9 and 10. The sons of Ephraim were archers equipped with bows, yet they turned back in the day of battle. They did not keep the covenant of God. They refused to walk in His law. Verse 17. They continued still to sin against Him, to rebel against the Most High in the desert. Verse 32. In spite of all this, they still sinned and did not believe in His wonderful works. Verse 36. They deceived Him with their mouth and lied to Him with their tongue. Verses 40 and 41. How often they rebelled against Him in the wilderness and grieved Him in the desert. Again and again they tempted God and pained the Holy One of Israel. Verse 56. Yet they tempted and rebelled against the Most High God and did not keep His testimonies. And remember, this was a people miraculously sustained by God in the wilderness so that they could say at the end of their journey, our shoes never wore out, our clothes never wore out, we always had food, we always had water, we were always guided, and we were always protected by God when we looked to Him alone. They got to see miracles in the wilderness that you and I can only imagine. Yet they failed over and over again. Are you leaving behind a confusing life story? Perhaps I can only look into my own life. I can't judge it for you. I don't know everything about your life. But when I look at my life, I had faithful grandparents. I have faithful parents who gave me an upbringing that was wonderful. I couldn't have changed a thing, wouldn't change a thing. Disciplined, loving, compassionate, consistent, biblical. Except for a very few times in my life, I have always been under very good elders. Wherever I've been a member, wherever I've worked as a preacher, I have had great elders, great mentors, other preachers who've guided me along and taught me things. I've had people who've held me accountable. I've married a beautiful, wonderful, strong, intelligent Christian woman. My kids are healthy. If I fall away from God, what possible excuse could I have? Other people in the Bible had inconsistent stories as well. When you look at Solomon, look at all the advantages that Solomon had. And by the end of his life, he had married 700 women and had 300 concubines, 1,000 sexual partners. And it was because of them that his heart had fallen away from serving God. And this was a man who loved God dearly at the beginning of his life and wanted to build a glorious temple for him. Adam has a confusing life story as well. Whatever happened to Adam? You always wonder, whatever happened to Adam? What about Noah? All that faithfulness, all that work, all the things that he went through to build the ark and to survive with his family. And the first thing that he does when he gets out of the ark is make a vineyard and become a drunkard. Gideon is the same way. Gideon and all his acts of faithfulness, but at the end of his life, he had made a golden ephod, set it up as an idol, and Israel was worshiping an ephod that Gideon had made. Uzziah is the same way. Uzziah, very good king in Judah, but his heart turned away from God. He went into the temple and wanted to offer incense that was not allowed for him to offer, and he became a leper until the day of his death. Josiah is the same way. Alan just preached on Josiah a couple weeks ago. Good man. Turned to God with all of his heart. And yet, how did Josiah die? In a really ill-conceived battle with Egypt. In a moment of arrogance and haughtiness, he inserted himself into international politics and died because of it. Joash is the same way. Good man. As long as the priest Jehoiada, who had basically raised him, was alive, Joash made good choices. But as soon as Jehoiada died, Joash started listening to bad advice and ended up having Jehoiada's own son killed because he prophesied against him. These are confusing stories, aren't they? Lots of good, but some pretty stupid mistakes along the way, too. And it leaves us wondering, what did his life really amount to? The hard thing is that we have to accept is there is no rehabbing a legacy in God's eyes, at least not without honesty. Now, we might be able to rehab a legacy in other people's eyes. Maybe near the end of life, we donate a bunch of money or we leave a bunch of money to our grandkids or something like that. And of course, they always remember us because they went and bought a Mustang with the money they got from their inheritance. So, sure, you can rehab a legacy in other people's eyes, but not in God's eyes. You can't pull the wool over His eyes. Look in verse 34 of Psalm 78. When he killed them, then they sought after him and returned and searched diligently for God. They remembered that God was their rock, the Most High God, their Redeemer. Okay, that seems pretty positive, doesn't it? But, and there's always a but in there, but they deceived him with their mouth and lied to him with their tongue. Their heart was not steadfast toward him, nor were they faithful in his covenant. God knew what was going on. They could go through the motions, they could go through the show and rehab their legacy, their story, make themselves feel better about the life that they lived. God wasn't tricked by it. Now, up until this point, I've talked a lot about ghost towns and 19th century history and legacies and that sort of thing, but maybe you're not the sort of person who goes in for Westerns. And if that's the case, that's fine. I happen to be a big fan of Westerns and John Wayne and all that sort of thing. I keep a poster of John Wayne from Hondo in my office here at the church building. So what I want to do is shift gears dramatically. And you'll see what I mean when I say shift gears dramatically from ghost towns and Westerns to Facebook. Facebook That, I believe, is something that most of us in here can understand. There are 1.7 billion people on planet Earth who are regular Facebook users. So out of the 1.7 billion people on Earth, it is more than likely that most of us in here have some association with social media. In a way, isn't Facebook becoming your Psalm 78? Isn't Facebook becoming the record of who you are, what you chose to present to the world of yourself? Like Psalm 78, it covers the big things on Facebook. We show off when we get married and when we have children and when we buy our first house and we put pictures up. We put our opinions out there. Sometimes we're willing to admit our failures and the mistakes that we've made, but for the most part, we like to tell people about our successes. But Facebook can also be very honest when it comes to our spiritual and moral failures as well. I've known many people on Facebook, and I've been guilty of it the same way. In a moment of trial and in a moment of doubt, you throw something out there on Facebook and you say, "I don't trust people anymore. Everybody betrays me. Friends are never there for me. I'm not so sure why I go to church anymore." And then a few days later, it works itself out, and you sheepishly have to go back on Facebook and say, "Well, my prayers were answered." Rebecca and I have a friend like that, and we're constantly seeing on Facebook the way she says, "This is another trial. I'm not going to get the bills paid this month. Where is God when you really need Him?" And then somehow or another, things, they work out. And she gets the bill paid, and she gets a good diagnosis from her doctor, and she has to come back on Facebook and say, "Prayers answered! Hallelujah! God is always there for me." Always there for us, huh? Like I said, Facebook sort of serves as our online biography. Like social media, Psalm 78 includes the main events condensed into little snippets. And it's not always flattering, and it tells a story in hindsight that I don't think the Israelites planned in advance. Nobody, when they set out from Egypt to go into the wilderness, nobody who set out to cross the Red Sea, nobody who set out from Mount Sinai, none of them set out with the intention of becoming unfaithful. None of them woke up that morning and said, "You know what I want? 3,000 years later, I want someone to study my life and say what a bad example I was. I want people to learn from all of the mistakes that I've made." Nobody sets out with that intention. I don't believe the Israelites did either. Remember, we have to give an account for everything that we've done in life. And maybe you might be able to scrub your image in other people's eyes or expunge everything of social media, scrub your image on the internet. God knows. God knows. Like it says in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, we're all going to be judged when we come to the judgment seat of Christ. And we will be judged for what we've done in the flesh, whether it was good or bad. And our choices, whether we announce them on Facebook or keep them private, it is not material. Our choices are crafting a history of ourselves. Our choices from day to day, our attitudes, our words are creating our legacy. And I believe, in a sense, that that's what Revelation 20 verse 12 is saying, that when John sees in this great revelation all the people of the earth, the great and the small, gathered together before the judgment seat, and books were opened, and the great book of life was opened, and we will be judged based on what's written in our book. Our legacy that we leave behind is going to be the basis for judgment. And our choices make the difference between heaven and hell in God's eyes. So how does your story read? Let me read a few things more out of Psalm 78, and the lesson will be yours. Because their legacy doesn't lie. And maybe in Psalm 78, maybe in the legacy of Israel, you see a little of yourself, or maybe a lot of yourself. Maybe you're making the same mistakes in how you're crafting your life story. Well, we see in their story acts of rebellion. Acts of rebellion. Perhaps you've shown that on Facebook. Maybe you've shared that in the world, or maybe you've kept it private. It doesn't matter to God. But acts of rebellion in verses 40 and 41, how often they rebelled against Him in the wilderness and they grieved Him in the desert. Does God take it personally when you rebel? Yeah. God is not able to be objective when it comes to our rebellion. He takes it personally. When we rebel against Him, it grieves Him. It hurts Him. And I wonder, as God scrolls through our book on the Day of Judgment, as He thumbs through our Facebook history, I wonder what kinds of things He's going to point at in my life as acts of rebellion. How about making God jealous? Verses 58 and 59. For they provoked Him with their high places and aroused His jealousy with their graven images. When God heard, He was filled with wrath and greatly abhorred Israel. What's in your life story that makes God jealous? How about consequences of a life without God? I think most of us can understand this one when we look on Facebook of the friend who's fallen away. The friend who we used to go to church with, who we used to see as a brother or sister, and they've fallen away from the faith. We get to watch basically a front row seat to what their life is like. One of the greatest disappointments I have as a preacher is that I was not able to reach a young man years ago. And if he ever watches this sermon, I hope that this stings him. I hope it stings. I taught that guy in Bible classes. We studied together. We counseled each other. We were iron sharpening iron. And he had a lot of spiritual problems that he wanted to work out. But as soon as he went off to college, almost as soon as he went off to college, he went off the deep end. And he's still a friend on Facebook. And I scroll through my Facebook every morning, and there he is, red solo cup in hand. Drug paraphernalia, women in bikinis. He's living the college life that he always wanted to, I guess. And in a sense, we get to sit there with front row seats and we get to watch what a life without God looks like. The misery and the emptiness of it. A failure to take up the fight. In verse 9, the sons of Ephraim were archers equipped with bows. They had what they needed to fight. Yet they turned back in the day of battle. When it was time for them to do something, they couldn't do it. How are you handling the fight? How about this election? How about the moral fights that you have in your daily life, the fights that you have to keep your kids on the straight and narrow? You have all the tools. Are you taking up the fight? Whining and complaining. This is where we get back to people on Facebook. Whining about the election. Whining about my job. Whining about my kids. You know, nobody's forcing you to go to work. Nobody forced you to have kids. Nobody's forcing you to vote for one or the other. Yet we whine and we complain because it's just easier to whine and complain, isn't it? You see that in verses 18 through 20. In their heart, they put God to the test by asking for food according to their desire. They spoke against God. They said, "Can God prepare a table in the wilderness? Behold, He struck the rock so that water gushed out and streams were overflowing. Can He give bread also? Will He provide meat for His people?" And oh, He provided meat, all right. He provided meat till it was up to their knees. It was pouring out of their nostrils, and while the meat was still stuck between their teeth, God disciplined them for their lack of restraint. Forgetting that life is made up of many hills and valleys. Your life is going to have good moments, and your life is going to have very bad moments. And sometimes the bad moments outweigh the good moments. But let's not get so caught up in one or the other that we forget that it is all temporary. In the euphoria of first getting married, in the euphoria of a baby being born, in the euphoria of a great job promotion and a new house, don't forget that all of those things do come with their own heartache at times. Challenges, trials. But if you're going through a trial, don't forget that it's temporary also. Nothing in this life lasts forever. It is by nature, by design, temporary. And finally, a bright but uncertain future. Let's end with verse 68 through 72. But God chose the tribe of Judah, Mount Zion, which he loved. And he built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth which he has founded forever. And he chose David, his servant, and took him from the sheepfolds. From the care of the ewes with suckling lambs he brought him to shepherd Jacob his people and Israel his inheritance. So he shepherded them according to the integrity of his heart and guided them with his skillful hands. The subtitle for Psalm 78 says it's a maschil of Asaph. And Asaph was one of the singers, poets, and musicians who was brought in during the reign of David to craft and create songs of worship and praise to God. So we don't get the rest of the story, do we? And we know in hindsight, if you've ever read 1st and 2nd Chronicles, that not everything turns out peachy in David's life, and not everything turns out quite right in his son's life, or his grandson's life, or a lot of his descendants. And eventually Judah is swallowed up by Babylon, taken away into captivity to learn its lesson about idolatry. In a way, that's kind of like all of our lives, isn't it? Opportunity. Positivity. Optimism. That we can make of ourselves what we want. That we get to choose. Am I going to use this trial to become a better person? Am I going to use suffering to perfect myself in endurance? Am I going to take my advantages, my gifts, my blessings, and make the most out of them and put them into service for God? I get to choose that, don't I? I get to choose my life story. Now, there's a lot of things that we don't get to choose. I understand that. But it is your choice as to how to respond to the things given to you in this life. And at the end of it, when your story is completed and your book is closed, you're the one who has to take responsibility for it. Judah had all the opportunities. David had all the opportunities. And Asaph sees a bright future. But the story wasn't over for them yet. Just like it's not over for you. You have an opportunity right now to make things right with God. If you're not a Christian, you need to become one. Let that be the great punctuation mark on your life so that when you die, no matter what else you've done in this life, whatever career you've had, other accomplishments, when you die, the great punctuation mark on your life is that he or she was a Christian, was a part of the body of Christ. And if you are a Christian and you've not been living right, this is the time in the story where you turn things around. This is the time in the story when the drama forces you, pushes you, motivates you to become something better than what you've been up to this point. Whatever need you might have, let it be known by coming forward as we stand and sing.